Certainly blessed to be together this morning. We invite you, brothers, here, welcome you here. It's a joy to have you here. We would certainly love to be able to visit with each one of you during these days together, and that might be difficult to do. But as it always is true at this meeting, it's true again this week that if any of you would like to visit with any of us, you're free to make that known, and we would like to arrange a time when we could do that. During these days that we're together, because your life is important to God and is to us. And this is a discipleship meeting. I often hear it called a leadership meeting. I'd like you to change that word to discipleship. I'd like you to turn that to a servanthood meeting. We learn to follow the Lord together and learn from Him together and learn from each other together. We're not trying to make great men out of you. We're trying to make small men out of you. All of us are too big already. The thing to do to walk with God is go the other direction. Everyone's climbing to the top of the mountain, but very few are trying to make their way to the bottom. There's more room at the bottom than there is at the top of any mountain. And so you'll find God at the bottom. Learn of me that I'm meek and lowly of heart. And that's where you find Him. So the song says, "We seek Thee where Thou dwellest on high, beyond the glittering starry sky. We find Thee where Thou dwellest below, besides the beds of want and woe." That's where you find God. And we want to have our hearts there. And we want God to take our hearts there these days as we're together here. We all need to be fed, don't we? We just sang that. This subject is on your program for a very unusual reason. I don't know whose fault it is for sure, but I got a phone call. I was in Costa Rica, and somebody on the other end asked me, of all the preachers that call on the phone and write letters, what is the biggest problem that they are facing? What are people asking you about? What are these preachers saying they're having trouble with in their churches? I probably should have thought more about it before I answered. It was a kind of a strange question to have to answer that by phone. And I kind of have a practice that when people call on the telephone and ask a hard question, I tell them I will not answer you now. I'll send it later to you by email. Because I like to think about it and pray about it. I don't like to give snap answers to deep questions like that. But in this case, I didn't think of that. And I said, well, I hear preachers saying all over the place that they're finding that their people don't have confidence in them, and they do not have confidence in their people either. And that has been a serious problem in homes. It's a serious problem all over the place. And then the brother on the other end said, would you speak on that subject then at Kingdom Fellowship for Men? So I got myself into a problem without realizing I was doing it. And it was that whole issue has to do with the place of authority in our lives. And so we like to look at that these days. Authority is a word that many of us maybe would scarcely want to hear. And others would be very, very glad to accept that word authority if they were in that place where they felt authority was given to them. We kind of feel better about it when we have a place of authority. Otherwise, we don't really appreciate many of us needing to respond to authority. One of the things I'm going to try to do in these 4 days is avoid saying something that you're going to expect me to say and is commonly said. I'm going to try to avoid saying authority over. I'm going to try to avoid saying being under authority. That phrase being under authority is in the King James Version in Matthew chapter 8, the centurion talking to Christ. But I'm going to try to avoid using this word authority to make it sound like we're in categories. I want to look at the word authority as a responsibility, as a function, as a work that we're responsible for, responsible to God for, and responsible to each other for. There was a young man this morning who had a responsibility, a place of authority, and a responsibility that none of you had. When you drove your car in this morning, there was a tall young fellow standing there, and he pointed and he directed. And you did well if you followed that instruction, and you did not do well if you didn't. And when you pulled in here, if you had your mind made up that I know where I'm going to park my car, and I know exactly where this thing is going to sit, and it's going to be where I want it to be, and you just simply ignored that person's instruction and took your own direction as he gave that to you, you're saying a lot about yourself. If we can't appreciate authority, there's something seriously wrong with us. And it's all over the place. You just don't live without it. And so, the nature of Bible authority, we like to look at that these days. But I'm asking this question, why is that thing in us which tends to resist, which tends to offer an alternative, which has another suggestion, which would have done this a better way? We think there's another way they could have done that. And I was preaching up there after the Bible school in first week of November, I think it was, and they had an evening service there, and there was going to be a lot of people there that night, and there was hardly any place to park the cars on that. It's a fairly large parking lot, but not enough for cars like that. I mean, a lot of people were coming in there, and so there were young men there directing the traffic, and of course, I have a wife that does not walk very well, and I don't have very good eyes, so I can't see in the dark. And so he directed us, that young man, and we're going way back here behind all these cars, and there's a long road back along this creek or a woods or at the very, very edge of this property, as far back as you could get. There was one little space left, and they told me to back in there, and it's hard enough to see because it was dark, and then I don't see where, and I can't see how far back I went, and so it was not an easy thing to do, but we parked there, and then we started work our way to where we were going. It was a long way to go. I think if that young man would have known everything that I knew, he may have made a few different decisions. But he didn't know it. It was for me to do what I was told to do. That's what we did. And I'd like to ask you, why might that be that we resist authority? Just what do you think the answer to that would be? All of us probably have some authority in one area or another of life. Everyone that's here, including the youngest young man that's here. I'm sure that all of you have authority in one area or another where you're responsible. So these four messages we have these days are going to be directed two directions, towards those that have places and responsibilities where there is authority, and those of us who find ourselves responsible to that authority. We want these messages to go two ways. The brothers already told you this morning that all authority has its origin in God. He is the blessed and only potentate. Do you know what that means? The blessed and only potentate. He is the King of kings and Lord of lords. It tells us that in 1 Timothy chapter 4. Our Bible says He's the sovereign Lord. That word is not used in English like it is in Spanish. But in Acts chapter 4, that's not a text, but I'm going to read it to you just so that you get this. You're acquainted with how it says it in the King James Version. And when they heard that, they lifted up their voice to God with one accord and said, Lord, thou art God, which hath made heaven and earth and sea and all that in them is. Spanish uses the word sovereign there. It's a very, very beautiful thought. It applies to God. All power means all authority. All power is given to me in heaven and earth. All authority is given to me in power, heaven and earth. And in your King James Bible, the word authority, Greek word authority, is translated power many, many times, as it is there in that Great Commission in Matthew 18. Many times in Spanish, that word is translated authority instead of power. So we have that difference when you read those two Bibles. But When your Bible has power in it, in the New Testament, many times that word power is authority. There are also three or four other English words that are used for that same term, but they're found very, very seldom in the New Testament. I won't be referring to those. But the word power, please understand it, that many times that is authority, and we need to understand that. There is none higher than God. Nor was there ever anyone more qualified to be the ultimate authority. God is not only the only potentate, as I've quoted to you, He is the only one who could possibly be the only potentate. God does not give to man His sovereignty, but He gives to man authority. That's an interesting observation. None of us are sovereign, though we have authority of one kind or another. So I can hardly continue these meditations without worshiping. I can hardly continue this without recognizing. We're before holiness here and tremendous power and wisdom and authority. It is an amazing story. I'd like you to find a text there in the book of Esther in chapter 10, the very end of the book of Esther. I'd like to read these three verses. Just looking at this idea of authority, that we have a lesson for this morning, and we'll see how far we get with that. This is Esther chapter 10. And the king Ahasuerus laid a tribute upon the land and upon the isles of the sea. That was easy to read, but that verse would not be in the Bible had not that king had what? He never could have done that. And do you see how far that authority reached? And all the acts of His power and of His might and the declaration of the greatness of Mordecai whereunto the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jews was next unto the king Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and accepted of the multitudes of his brethren, seeking the wealth of his people and speaking peace to all his seed. There's several kinds of authority here that I'd like to look at just briefly. The passage speaks of the authority of Ahasuerus. He could levy tribute, if he wished to, upon land, upon the isles. You see that here. He had the authority to do that. He could set up people and put them down. He did both as you studied these 10 chapters. You see that he set up Mordecai here in these, it refers to that. In verse 2, he had power to do that. And he did it. So there's no authority in this person. This is civil power. This is political power, perhaps. But I'm more interested in the nature of Mordecai's authority. Why was he great among the Jews? And we are told why. We are told why he was held in high esteem by the entire city of Shushan. If you look back there, chapter 8 and verse 15, this will be real quick. You can just jump back there. It's not very many pages to turn in your Bible. And Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, and with a great crown of gold, and with a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. Why was that? His authority did not begin with his advancement by the king, though he was advanced by the king. But he had authority before that. And his authority is not found in the position that he was given, so much of it is found in the quality of his character before he was given it. Who was this Mordecai? What kind of person was he? If you want to learn what makes authority, if you'd like to be that kind of a person in your life, look at the life of Mordecai. It was not a happenstance. It was not an accident. His authority was evident in Esther's respect to his own cousin, her respect for him, and her obedience to him. But there's a very, very interesting verse in this book of Esther, in chapter 4, verse 17, and you might like to turn there real quickly. This is one of the characteristics of people that have true authority, Bible authority. Look what verse 17 says. That's the last verse in chapter 4. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. Now that's interesting. And that's the way authority works. For 32 years, I've chaired the meetings of the board of our publishing house in Costa Rica. I have responsibility there, and we have employees there, and we have a lot of different committees that function in conjunction with the publication board. We have several administrators that have various assignments there in the publishing house. But when one of those employees sends me a letter and says, Brother Dale, we would like you to do this and this for us, and we like this handled this way, and we like the focus to be this, and we like you to spend this much time and arrange it like this here and present us maybe so many words or 2,000 words or who knows what. Could you do this by such as the date? I grab my Duke book and write that stuff down, and I'm responsible to them and they're not responsible to me. And now I want to do what I'm asked to do. Do you understand how that works? That's included in this thing. We see that in Mordecai, I hear. And people with true authority in their lives, that's the way it works. Amen. Just so happens that that young man that directed me to park my car this morning is now sitting and listening to me speak. He's in this assembly. As he's sitting listening to me, he feels a little bit different about it from the way he felt when he was standing out there in the cold this morning. It's the same person. But he will listen. I know him very well, and the last time I saw him, we had a very, very deep conversation. I'll never forget it, I don't think. He asked me a very, very deep question about his personal life. See how this works? It's a beautiful picture. So I thought I'd start with this little passage there and help us get that view into our hearts. Now, we like to take this subject of the nature of Bible authority, look at it in four ways. You might be a little surprised at the first one, but I want to talk to you first about the anatomy of a rebellion. That's today. Tomorrow, then, looking at the very, very opposite picture, the authority of our Lord Jesus Christ. And then on Thursday, if the Lord tarries, how does Bible authority function, especially in a practical way in our local churches and our local settings where we are? And then I'd like to nurture and invert on Friday morning a high level of confidence in one another here, between us and others, nurturing that confidence among us. So let's get started here with this nature of anatomy. If I'm not, this anatomy of a rebellion, if I'm not mistaken, I think someone gave you a song sheet. I don't really need this song for today. I like it for tomorrow. But instead of leaving this song sheet on your chair, you people came with your Bibles, you came with notebooks, you came with some kind of a way to keep your collection of ideas together. Maybe just fold this sheet when you're finished and keep it with you. So when you're back here tomorrow morning, it's here. There's going to be a public service tonight. These sheets will be everywhere. If you don't know where they are, you're not going to have it. We'd like it for tomorrow morning especially. But why don't we stand and sing this song? And it was this song comes from a hymn book from which Brother John got one of the songs we sang this morning. You saw it said there, Brethren Hymnal. And that hymnal is quite a few years old. It's over 100 years old. And this hymn book is this hymn is number 13 in that book. And some of you brethren people here know this song. Since o'er thy footstool here below, thy radiant such radiant gems are strewn, and that word is pronounced much like the word moon. Oh, what magnificence but glow, great God, about thy throne! So brilliant here these drops of light, there the full ocean rolls, how bright. And this song does that in every stanza. It takes light, as you and I understand it, in comparison with God, with what it must be like where God is. And I need this for tomorrow. If night's blue curtains of the sky with thousand stars inwrought, hung like a royal canopy with glittering diamonds fraught, be, Lord, thy temple's outer veil, just the outer veil, what splendor at thy shrine must dwell. The dazzling sun at noonday hour, forth from his flaming base, flinging o'er earth the golden shower to vale and mountain blaze. But chose the Lord one beam of thine, what then the day where thou dost shine? Oh, how shall these dim eyes endure that noon of living rays? Or how our spirits so impure upon thy glory gaze? Anoint, O Lord, anoint our sight, and fit us for that world of light. This is the message we have here. Okay, so I don't have a pitch pipe, but let's try to sing it.
Dost du, since all thy footsteps hear me,
Bible to 1 Kings chapter 11. There are many sad stories in the Bible. This is certainly a sad story. The anatomy of a rebellion. When we think of the concept of authority, several other themes almost immediately present themselves to our minds. We think about the abuse of authority. That's something quite well known among us. There's this whole idea of delegated authority. And then, of course, you can't go very far with this word until we have the thought of submission to authority. And that brings us to the idea of Bible obedience. There's also such a thing as contempt for authority or resistance to it. And that brings us to the idea of rebellion against authority. I'd like us to understand this morning that there's never any reason for a Christian who practices the golden rule, as you've heard it encouraged this morning, there's no reason ever for a Christian to rebel against authority. There's never a time to do that. There's never an appropriate time for a Christian to rebel against the authority. And even if we cannot obey the authority, what authorities ask us to do, because we're disobeying God if we do it, there should be respect and honor for the authority, even while we need to break rank with some of those injunctions. But there's never a reason to be rebellious against authority. The Bible talks about the froward, the ones that are difficult to work with, difficult to live with, difficult to relate to. And the brother has that coming up later for us. And yet there's a lot of rebellion against authority. You certainly have seen that in your newspapers, or if you have other ways of obtaining your news these days. I don't know if anyone reads newspapers anymore, but you see a tremendous amount of rebellion on the streets of Portland and many other, many places. Rebelling against the police forces of your country. Turning the police vehicles upside down and setting them on fire. There's no end to rebellion these days. And we get used to it. Do you do this? Does this happen? Do we find ourselves in enjoying some of the aspects of rebellion that we hear about or see the videos playing, or does it kind of look interesting to us that that kind of thing was happening there? You must remember that every time that happens to us, we're doing something to our own authority. Every time that attitude, every time that rises, that spirit, that resistance rises, that kind of having fellowship with that own fruit for works of darkness and kind of having appreciation for that rebellion that's out there, every time that happens, we've done something to ourselves. And God knows about that. I realize there's reasons why there's rebellion out there to some extent. These people are not all Christians. They are not all kingdom Christians for sure. They're not living by the golden rule, the words of Christ, the Sermon on the Mount. They're not living guided by those precepts. They don't have that nature in their heart. That divine infusion is not in them. So they respond to these things. And when they're treated wrong or feel that something is unjust or improper, that's the only answer they have for it. That happens a lot of times in rebellions. As I speak these words to you today, I think some of you know that I would have had reason and have had reason and have responded wrong to not appreciate authorities that were there at times and places in my life. But my concern this morning is that my unfaithfulness or impropriety or lack of understanding or consideration, God save me from ever causing a rebellion in somebody else. Would you please accept that concern for your own life? So don't let me cause rebellion in my children. Don't let me cause a rebellion in my wife. Don't let me cause a rebellion in the dear brothers and sisters in the church. Dear God, I'm capable of that. Dear God, we'll see that here. We're going to see that here. David is ample proof that one can continue to respect very faulty and tyrannical authority. He did that with King Saul, didn't he? I don't need to take your time for that. You know that is true. If David did that, you can do that. But we see conflicts in the churches and serious problems with our youth in the homes, and we see strikes and walkouts in the marketplace and defiance against law enforcement, even in our cities. What is the cause of all this? We want to study the anatomy of a rebellion, and we'll see if we can reduce this just a little bit there. That clock is going to keep on walking its way around that center, so we'll see what we can do here. In chapter 11, that's where you are. The first 8 verses gives us the backdrop of this story. It talks about Solomon's apostasy in these first 8 verses. I guess I won't read this to you because you know that story. And he has married these strange women, and they have each one their gods. And though it seems like he handled this quite discreetly at the beginning when he first married these girls, by this time in his ministry, in his age, he's about 58 years old, by this time he is worshiping these gods. And they're named for us here, and God will name them later. God knows all about this. And God is very concerned about this, and very few people were ever given in life what Solomon was given. Very few people ever had the opportunities in life that this young man had. At a very early age, he was put into the throne. His father David had done, and his father David made his own mistakes. But his father David had given to him a kingdom that was 10 times larger than what he had received 40 years before. Solomon is the king of a very vast amount of territory, and he has wisdom and funds and possibilities like no man had before him or probably after him. And this is what he did with it. In 40 years' time, this is what he got. This is where it went in his life. This man who wrote these Psalms or these Proverbs. This man that the Queen of Sheba came to visit and the half has not been told me. This great man who did not ask for wisdom or greatness or wealth, but got all three of them. This man whom God blessed, this man whom God met with personally several times at distinct moments in his ministry and in his responsibility, God met with him. It was a personal contact with God. He had that experience with God. And so this man's apostasy is a backdrop for what comes next in these verses. The Lord responds to this in verse 9. The Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned away from the Lord God of Israel, which had appeared unto him twice. And so he tells Solomon something's going to happen to his administration, to his posterity. Something's going to happen here. And then we find in verses 14 and following that God raised up three adversaries for Solomon. This part of Solomon's reign is not very common to us, not very familiar to us, excuse me. We don't know much about this. I'm not going to say much about it either, but in verses 14 to 22, we have this Hadad here, this Edomite, and tells us who he was. It tells us a little bit about his relationship to Solomon's kingdom. It talks about him. He's one of the enemies that was raised up. We have in there in 23 to 25, Rezin, the son of Eliada. And not very much is said about him, but he was an adversary to Solomon. God raised him up, or God allowed that to happen. And then the third person is one that you all know very well. His story begins in verse 26. I'd like to start reading there. Jeroboam. And Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, an Ephrathite of Zerida, Solomon's servant, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow woman. Of course, if she was a widow, she had to be a woman, I guess. Even he lifted up his hand against the king. And this was the cause that he lifted up his hand against the king. Solomon built Milo and repaired the breaches of the city of David, his father. And the man Jeroboam, and please pay close attention to this verse, it's very important for what comes later, was a mighty man of valor. And Solomon, seeing the young man that he was industrious, he made him ruler over all the charge of the house of Joseph. That's two tribes. And it came to pass at the time Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem to the prophet Ahijah, the Shilonite found him in the way, and he had clad himself with a new garment, and they too were alone in the field, that Ahijah caught the new garment that was on him and rent it in 12 pieces. And he said to Jeroboam, "Take thee 10 pieces, for thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will rend the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon, and will give 10 tribes to thee. But he shall have one tribe for my servant David's sake, and for Jerusalem's sake, the city which I have chosen of all the tribes of Israel, because they have forsaken me, and have worshipped Ashtaroth, the god of the Zidonians, and Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Milcom, the god of the children of Ammon, and have not walked in my ways, to do that which is right in mine eyes, and keep my statutes and my judgments, even as did David his father. Howbeit, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand, but I will make him prince all the days of his life for David my servant's sake, whom I chose because he kept my commandments and my statutes. But I will take the kingdom out of his son's hand. That's not Solomon now, but his son. And will give it unto thee, even 10 tribes. And unto his son will I give 1 tribe, that David my servant may have light always before me in Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen to put my name there. And I will take thee, and thou shalt reign according to all that thy soul desireth, and shall be king over Israel. There shall be, if thou wilt hearken unto all the things, to all that I command thee, and will walk in my ways, and do that is right in my sight, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, that I will be with thee, and will build thee a sure house, as I built for David, and I will give Israel unto thee. And I will for this afflict the seed of David, but not forever. And Solomon sought therefore to kill Jeroboam, and Jeroboam arose and fled to Egypt, unto Shishak, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt on the death of Solomon. Now, may I just note something here? And then Solomon died. The ending verses here speak of that death. And his son Rehoboam becomes king. You've observed with me in this reading the background for this rebellion. I said the title is The Anatomy of a Rebellion. If you don't know what anatomy is, it's the study of the parts of your body and how they function together. It takes all these pieces, all of these elements, all of these organs, all of these members to form a body. And so your anatomy is the study of your physiology. The anatomy of rebellion is to understand what are the elements that contributed to that rebellion. Those elements are all found in there. And you can, a rebellion in that sense is predictable because you see the elements for it. You see the anatomy of it. You understand what a rebellion looks like and how it is fomented. And so knowing that, when you see these elements taking place in a society, in your congregation, in your family, you can look, you're looking down the barrel of a predictable result. And that's why we're talking about the anatomy of this thing, because I want you to be able to identify how it happens and what is included and what is going to turn out later to be a very upsetting and difficult experience and something God never wants us to have. And so we can avoid it. And especially avoid it when you see these elements beginning to take place in your own life. When you see, as people affect you and or mistreat you or misrepresent you or violate you in some kind of way or another, and you see these elements that we have here before us beginning to rise in our hearts, that we notice it. Because we cannot have this rebellion against God. And our rebellion against Rehoboam in this case, our rebellion against President Biden, our rebellion against the police force in Los Angeles, our rebellion is against God. When you get down to it, rebellion goes back to the highest of all authority, to the highest potentate. That's where it goes. And it tells you that in Romans chapter 13. I don't have time to take you there, but it tells us there that when we resist the powers, which are civil in that context, in 13 of Romans, we're resisting God. And it tells us there that it will not go well for us if we do that. And so all of us should be aware of that. We're sitting here this morning and we're men and we have responsibilities. And we're trying to disciple you into thinking properly about this subject. So a few observations and quickly. This Jeroboam was an outstanding man. Though he was very young, it says here he was a mighty man of valor. You read those words. And though he had very little experience, he was extremely industrious. This man got things done. When Solomon chose him with his ambitious building programs that he had, which he taxed the Israelites tremendously heavy in order to get all this done, he chose this young man and gave him a great charge of several of the tribes of Joseph, it says here. And he was responsible for that group of men. And they themselves were, if you know what the Ephraimites were like, they were powerful. They were powerful people. That was a strong tribe. He was in charge of them. This man was capable of doing that. And so God speaks to this Jeroboam by a prophet. And soon we have a brand new piece of clothing here lying on the ground in 12 pieces. And the prophet Ahijah tells this young industrious gentleman to pick up 10 of those pieces. Explains to him why you heard that story. I don't need to go over that with you. This is how God called this young man and made a tremendous promise to him. As he explained the reason for this unusual visitation. The promise that God made to this king is conditional. I read it to you in verses 35 through 38. And God did want to bless this young man. God saw promise in him. God sees promise in you. And God made some offers here. Somehow, you and I don't know how, but King Solomon got wind of this. King Solomon learned about this whole thing, this visitation, these 10 pieces of cloth. Solomon got wind of this, and Solomon was not feeling very good about it, and he tried to, in his carnal way, tried to respond to this thing. And though he was not a man of war, he was looking at the possibility of at least doing some kind of bloodshed around here. And none of it was Jeroboam's fault. Up to now, Jeroboam has made no mistakes. Up to now, Solomon was fighting against... Okay. Did you get that? Just very, very foundational, isn't it? Talk about the anatomy of a rebellion. So this happens today. I was probably never as industrious as was Jeroboam. There's a lot of similarities in my story and his as I read what I find here. It may have happened to you in a very similar way. Or maybe some of us, inadvertently or otherwise, may have caused this story to be repeated in the life of another precious person. I trust never, dear God, please help us, dear Father, to not do that. But all of a sudden, this wise young man, this industrious person, this man of valor, this person who's capable of taking the strength of several tribes and directing that energy towards these building projects, all of a sudden this young man is a threat to somebody else in authority. When you have a bishop come to you as a young man and tell you that you being in his congregation is a threat to him, It's just a threat to me, Dale, to have you in my church. When someone comes and tells you that, it takes a tremendous amount of closeness with God to keep those wrong feelings from responding and from controlling what you do from there on. It's very easy to make serious mistakes, dear people, when that happens. And I could ask you this morning, just why would a young man ever be a threat to you? Would anyone like to volunteer an answer to that question? You just think about some of those things. The establishment is scared of his ability, seeks to destroy his effectiveness. And there he goes off into a far country. Both sides are about to lose. Dear Daddy, do not chase your son away from home. Pastor, do not condemn a talented young brother who may have some needs in his life and who desperately needs the firm hand of a shepherd to guide him. But instead, you look at it as something else and he feels your resistance towards him and knows that he cannot stay here. Be an instrument for restoration, not for the cause of rebellion. 2 Kings chapter 12, verse 1. And Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel were come to Shechem to make him king. And it came to pass when Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who was yet in Egypt, heard of it, for he was fled from the presence of King Solomon, and Jeroboam dwelt in Egypt, that they sent and called him. And Jeroboam and all the congregation of Israel came and spake unto Rehoboam, saying, thy father made our yoke grievous. Now therefore make thou the grievous service of thy father, and his heavy yoke which he put upon us lighter, and we will serve thee. And he said unto them, depart ye for 3 days. Then come again to me, and the people departed. You see, Jeroboam was well known in Israel, especially to those two tribes. He had served with them, tribes of Joseph. Evidently, not everyone in Israel went down to Shechem to make Rehoboam king, because a few of them went a little further. They went down to Egypt. And they found Jeroboam down there. And they felt that this man that they respected and appreciated, that had guided them, they saw his capacities, they knew his abilities, they wanted him to represent them to this new king. He was kind of a vocero. He was kind of a spokesman. He was kind of the person that they chose to represent them on this occasion. And they found Jeroboam. And this request, which you just read here, was done in a respectful way. They had full intentions at this point of being loyal. And the king said, "Depart for 3 days. We'll take a look at this after a while." At this point, the young king remembered his father Solomon, the wisdom of Solomon. And he thought of the elderly counselors that advised his father. And so he consulted with them. Now, these people here from Israel, they come down here and they've talked to me, and they're saying they brought this Jeroboam along. I don't know if Rehoboam knew his father's attitude towards this promising young man or not. But Jeroboam spoke there. Jeroboam showed up there. And so they gave some very well-chosen advice in verse 7. They signaled him, saying, "If thou wilt be a servant unto this people this day, and wilt serve them and answer them, and speak good words to them, then they will be thy servants forever." But Rehoboam had his own idea of authority. He had his own idea of how to be impressionable. He had his own idea of how to maintain and exercise control over others. He had his own idea of how that was to be done. He felt that his voice, he felt that his influence, he felt that his decisions have got to reflect his supremacy. He felt that he must impress these people with his placement, with his new calling. He needs to somehow or another step up to this high rank that he has now received. That he needs to subdue these people and keep them under this power that he has. So there are some courtiers around there that he knew, and they were kind of young fellows, and they played soccer together, and they were buddies, and they text each other all the time, and they read each other's status. So Rehoboam checks with them. The young man which had grown up with him, verse 10, spake with him, saying, Thus shalt thou speak to this people that spake unto thee, saying, "Thy father made our yoke heavy, but make thou it lighter unto us." Thus shalt thou say unto them, "My little finger shall be thicker than my father's loins. And now, whereas my father did laid you with heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father has chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions." So the 3 days were over. And they brought this northern kingdom back again. I want to start reading verse 12. So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam on the third day, as the king had appointed, saying, "Come to me again the third day." And the king answered the people roughly, and forsook the old men's counsel that they gave him, and spake to them after the counsel of the young men, saying, "My father made your yoke heavy, and I will add to your yoke. My father also chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions." Therefore the king hearkened not unto the people, for the cause was from the Lord, that he might perform his saying which the Lord spake by Ahijah the Shilonite, unto Jeroboam the son of Nebat. How do we talk to our children, to our erring children, to our mistaken youth? How do we talk to them? Are we under Spirit's control in our brothers' meetings, in our members' meetings, in our churches? How do we offer correction to an employee? Is there anger in the tone of our voice? Verse 15 is a commentary that God puts in here. This is not necessarily part of the story. Verse 15 is a commentary. Wherefore the king hearkened not unto the people, for the cause from the Lord. What would be God's commentary upon the exercise of my authority? I wonder what God would say about that. Did Rehoboam have to sin like this? Did Rehoboam have to cause this rebellion? Did Rehoboam need to show this wrong concept of authority to the near people that he was responsible to? Did he have to do that just because God had made a decree, just because God had told him to pick up 10 pieces of cloth? Did Rehoboam have to do this? So the people respond to the king in verses 16 through 19. So when all Israel saw that the king hearkened not unto them, the people answered the king, saying, what portion have we in David? Neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel, now see to thine own house, David. So Israel departed unto their tents. To thy tents, to your tents, O Israel, was a predictable response in this story. Any wise person would have known that. There were cracks in the foundation of this monarchy, that's Rehoboam's monarchy, before this verse came up. But now the division is sure. And what we're looking at here is the anatomy of a rebellion. And I should take the time to make a list for you of the various elements that are in this anatomy, that are in this composite, this picture of this rebellion we see here. There are other rebellions in the Bible. I chose this one. There are others in the Scripture, but this one is quite memorable. It's quite impressionable. And anyone reading this thing with any kind of a clear mind knows that the result is going to be how it turned out. The sin of Rehoboam included more than the pride of ambition and the lust for power. It included something else. Look at verses 15 and 16. It says it twice. Wherefore the king hearkened not unto the people. He did not hear them. He did not listen to them. Verse 16 says, so when the Israel saw that the king hearkened not unto them, he would not listen to them. He would not hear their words. You see, the important thing is to not only hear the words of a troubled daughter, is try to understand the troubled daughter. It's not only to know that the young fellow in the church was given permission to tell you his words, but that his pastor truly, truly, sincerely tried to understand his words. Sit down here, son. I need to... Whether you're right or wrong is not the point right now. I desperately want to understand how you're feeling. One of the wisdom, something that's wise in authority, is when a person responsible for others realizes that when a person comes to a tension in his life, a problem in his life, it's hard for him to bring it out. He's not quite sure how it's going to be received, so he's scared and he's nervous. And he blotches out a lot of strong feeling along with his words, and maybe says some things he shouldn't have said. and it comes through too pronounced, it comes through too hard and too loud. But a wise person with responsibility understands that and says, son, it's okay. I know that it was hard for you to say that, and it's going to probably come spilling out different from what you wish it would. Please don't worry about that. I understand that. The important thing right now is that you are able to be understood here. I want to know what's going on. And though the young man should try to be respectful before the eldership or however that's, whatever the context happens to be at the time, yet a wise administrator, a person under godly authority, understands those things very well. And just that very understanding is an important thing in getting things back together. And at least give you that person a chance, at least a possibility for it, and stop that rebellion. But this refusal to communicate, this refusal to understand, this refusal to consider the hearts that alienate these that I so much need in my life, and there they go, and I don't know how to listen. That's the problem. That was one of the serious problems of Rehoboam. And of course, along with that problem, he had something else wrong with him. He did listen, but to the wrong thing completely. He had a chance to listen to the right thing. God gave him every possibility to have responded to this thing right, and he responded wrong. To your tents, O Israel, is a predictable response. Any wise person would have known that. But there's something else that they called to your attention. There was a rupture in this kingdom before this day. There was a rupture in this kingdom before Rehoboam became king. I'll just read it to you quickly. I don't want to make a big point of this because that clock has said something else. This happened back in Joshua's time. I'm in chapter 18 of Joshua, verse 5. They shall divide it into seven parts. Judah shall abide in their coast on the south, and the house of Joseph shall abide in their coast on the north. That division was way back there. This north and south idea, this Joseph-Judah idea was way back there. It was greatly accentuated years later, in 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 1 there, when we have Saul dead now, and we have Abner, and we have Joab. You remember those stories very, very well. That difference was accentuated. But David had the grace and the power and the capacity to bring that together. He brought those two together into one in a very, very beautiful way. And Solomon benefited from that. He benefited from that union. And he capitalized on it and made this kingdom extremely great with his building projects and all that he did, and with a heavy taxation and all that he did. But the people were tired of it. And then somebody else came along. And they had a Jeroboam who was already prepared, already mistreated, already misrepresented, already was a threat. And they brought that young man in here, and now this happens. When this king came to the throne, he had these two things against him. The kingdom was divided this way, north and south. It was divided this way. 2.5 tribes, 9.5 tribes. The division was already, the cracks were already in the kingdom. I wanted to show you those cracks. A few lessons for us, and I must quit. What we have covered here is not the end of the story. Within a short time, there were two golden calves in Israel. Over 20 times we read in 1 Kings and 2 Kings of this Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. That comes up and comes up and comes up more than 20 times in your King James Version. God speaks to Jeroboam in chapter 14 of 8. In chapter 14, verse 8, I'm not going to take time to turn it down, I'm sorry, but those words are such precious words that God said to Jeroboam, Jeroboam, I tried. Jeroboam, I gave you an opportunity. Jeroboam, where were you? Jeroboam, what happened? Suppose you put your own name in there. Take Jeroboam's name out, put your name in. God speaks to you, young man, young pastor, young bishop, brother, You're running a carpenter crew. Brother, you have these responsibilities in your life. Why did it turn out this way for you? Why do you find yourself without a church? Why do you find your children leaving home? What is going on in your life? Didn't you see the signs? Didn't you know what happened? Weren't you aware of how this takes place in a young person's life? Don't you know how people feel when you respond to them that way? What did you expect was going to happen? And God's speaking to us. The Bible tells us why this sin happened. Who says this sounds terrible? Here's a mighty man of valor. Here's a man who's industrious. Here's a man who gets things done. The Bible says he was scared. He's scared. He's afraid that people go south to Jerusalem to worship God. Brothers, to be called upon to pastor a rebellious people, to be called upon to be king of a rebellious nation, to be called upon to participate in and to then become a bishop for, an elder for, a rebel group of people is a terrible assignment. I'm sorry I don't have time, but may I please tell you this. In a state up here in the United States, there was a congregation of the Eastern Pennsylvania Mennonite Church. And some of you might know that that's a fairly conservative, Brother John, you know what I'm talking about. Probably more conservative in some ways than what you and I would be. And they are, they just have the things pretty well together. And this congregation was in a state up here, and quite a few families in the congregation pulled out from the church. They just felt they could not handle it. They just felt they could not handle that, some of that kind of administration. I won't go any further than that. And they left, and they called me and asked me if I would come and provide oversight for their congregation. It's happened to me either two or three times. I think it's three times that people have left Eastern churches have asked me to do that in the last couple of years. And I just felt I could not do that. And so here's what I did. I called the bishop, the Eastern bishop that was responsible for that church. And said, Brother, I won't give his name. I'm not going to embarrass anybody here. They tape these messages. They travel sometimes. And I said, I was asked about that, and I just felt I really need to call you. Brother, do you have any advice? I don't know what happened there. Would you listen to the words of this brother? I don't know where God ever gave him these words. He said, Brother Dale, before you say no, would you please do something for me before you say no to those families? Before you say no, would you please consider with me where they might go if you don't help them? Would you consider the route they might take? Could you consider where they might be with their children some years from now? Before you say no, would you please think about that? What was he doing? What was he doing? He was preventing a rebellion. I'll tell you another story. This happened in Costa Rica, not in the States. There were two congregations in Costa Rica that were a bit more careful, narrow, more restrictive in their church expressions and practices than what we were. And one of these congregations had asked their administration for the opportunity to make some changes that same concilio, that same fellowship of churches in the States had made these same changes up there, and they wanted to make these changes in Costa Rica. And so they went to their eldership with a list of petitions there for some changes they wanted to make in that congregation. And the administration met with their associated elders, and they came back to the congregation with this decision that all those who signed this petition and have this direction in view for their lives, they have 6 months to find another congregational home. Living some 2.5 hours away, I learned about this. I went to some of our brothers in our churches and told them, we cannot stand this. We cannot have this. We did not permit this. These are going to be nationals. They're going to be leaving. It's the American families that live in that congregation that will stay. The nationals will leave. They'll have no place to go. We cannot have this. Brothers, what should we do? And the decision was that I should go up there and try to meet with these nationals and do something to solve this. Do do something to prevent it, to do something to change this, to do something to save those national people. So the first thing I did was I went to the minister of the congregation. And he was very glad to receive me. And we sat down together. I said, "Brother, can you tell me what's going on in the church here? Why this decision? 6 months to leave everybody. Is there some way we can handle this? Can you tell me what happened here? How did you ever get to this point? We need to save these national people." And here's what he told me. "Oh, brothers," he said, "Brother Dale, I'm sorry. I cannot tell you what's happening in our church. I only know one thing. There is no rebellion among those national members. It is not rebellion." He said, "Dale, would you try to help us? Dale, would you sit down with us? Dale, would you?" As a result of the following negotiations and visits, the same council came back, the same administrative eldership came back and said this: "The majority of the people have these concerns, and they're valid concerns. And what we would like to do is, if anyone in the congregation would like to retain the original, more defined position, they may find something else, but the others may all stay. And it's okay if they find help from these other brothers here. We'll accept that and work with that." We were able to save all the national members in that church. And only three families left. And they left. They were the American families that left, not nationals. And we have a beautiful relationship with all those families to this day. In fact, one of those families that left and one of the ministers that left is in Costa Rica preaching right now. I plan to be with him next week. Preaching in the very community that was among some of the very same people that withdrew at that time. That's the way it is. I was moderating the meeting when all the two congregational groups were together and the decision made to pass the administration from that denomination, that group, to us. The young minister told me there's no division here, no rebellion here. He had an opening meditation. And the bishop then, the elder, came up front and explained what was going on and gave the responsibility over to us. And I went into the pulpit to accept that responsibility. The meeting was dismissed. I stepped down from the pulpit. The young man who had been the minister of this church had that evening meditation. A tall man, much taller than I am, walked up to me, stood right in front of me, started to cry, put his forehead here in my chest, weeping like a little boy. Then we hugged each other there in that aisle. Well, the young man in the congregation was going to be staying and would be with us now. Walked back this aisle, met the bishop coming front this way. They met in the aisle and couldn't go any further. They had a weeping, a blessing with each other. That spirit has existed now for over 20 years. There's no reason to have We don't need to be part of it, brothers. We should be known to be those who will do all we can to prevent it. We're not here to cause it or be part of it. And I pray that these few words this morning would help set a tone for this meeting this week. And God is not the author of confusion. He's the God of peace. And may the Lord bless you, brothers, richly today.